Well, yeah, it's great to connect. I've been following along with a lot of stuff that you put out and really appreciate you taking some time to talk carbs. I really appreciate you fielding some questions I had on Instagram. And I think that we'll get into it, but I'll have you introduce yourself. And I don't know if it's like a new study. Have you published all that stuff yet, or is it just kind of things you've been talking about?
Well, it's yeah, just something like a kind of an idea, and then yeah, unpublished stuff. So can't really talk too much into details because, well, it needs to go through the peer review.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll hit on just whatever you can talk about and the points that you'd kind of talked about on different podcasts. And I think it's just I'm still I guess not amazed, but I'm interested that we're just still learning more about a macronutrient called carbs and how to time it precisely. And it seems like it's still a moving target, which I don't know, does that surprise you at all, or there's just still more, and I'm sure so much to go for sports science.
I feel like we do like two steps ahead and then one step backwards every few years. So it's kind of like sometimes we are recycling ideas that were explored like 20 years ago, and then sometimes I get an idea, oh, what if we could do that? And then you look at old studies and you found, oh, they have already done this 25 years ago or something.
It's interesting. I think, well, let's do your intro. Everybody, thanks for checking out the podcast. I'm Brendan Hausler, and I have a great guest, Tim Podlegar, sports scientist. I'd actually like you to introduce yourself because I could give a resume and talk about you for minutes on end, but I'm curious what are the highlights to you. So, please tell the people, who is Tim Podlegar?
Well, he's an exercise physiologist, and I mainly probably like these days do like sports nutrition, exercise metabolism stuff. I'm mainly like a researcher, let's say, employed by the University of Birmingham in the UK, where I do like research in the field of carbohydrate metabolism and currently like heat exposure, so in hot climates. But then probably I'm more known for my work at Bora Hansgrohe as one of their nutritionists, and I'm also involved in some other like smaller projects there and then. But basically, yeah, my life is all about carbohydrates, I guess.
I love it. Carbs, carbs, carbs. What got you into this field of study, and what's the kind of quick and dirty of how you've gotten yourself from maybe when you were in university until now that had you so focused on this?
I don't really know what got me into this, but I guess it all started with like hearing about a professor called Tim Noakes. And at the time, I heard about him just because of like some endurance stuff when I was still an undergrad student. And then I started like reading more about him, and I found him as an interesting personality. And at the time, like being very inexperienced, I just started like reading his comments, and he was making a claim that low carbohydrate diets are the way to go. And I started following that. And then I also started cycling myself at the time just to like introduce myself into a new sport. And then I really enjoyed it, low carbohydrate diets. I was like a promoter of low carb diet for a couple of years or so. And then I got to Birmingham to do my master's here, and obviously Birmingham being one of the universities which is most well known for carbohydrate research, Asker Jokendrup coming from here, and now Gareth Wallace, my boss, doing great stuff in carbohydrate metabolism and actually demonstrating how important carbohydrates are. So I kind of switched sides while I was here, and then yeah, for some reason, like just like I got really interested in this, probably because of this all this controversy around Tim Noakes, and now we are on opposite sides of the argument, I guess.
That is so, okay. So I was wondering, like, Tim didn't answer my question when I asked him about Tim Noakes, what he thinks. And so I'm glad you saved that for the podcast. And for the, we'll probably, this episode's not going to post until March. So people who have been following me on Strava know I have been pro carb. I am still pro carb. I think I'm getting more precisely timed carb though. I probably have promoted carbs a little too much, I would say. I'm an older athlete at 42 years old, and I've had some, I guess, inflammation. Going lower carb has changed my back pain, and I'm kind of mind blown. So I'm sort of like in between the two camps. So it's interesting that to hear you be a low carb opponent. What changed that? Was there a specific, was there a downside that you had when you were low carb that you were like, wait a minute, I'm wrong about this? Or how did that happen?
Well, that's kind of the thing. Like, is I started low carb and I started cycling at the same time. So I had no exposure to being a high carb and a cyclist. Basically, I was young at the time, so I was flying. I was faster than everyone else around me because I was younger than them. Because I was like cycling in my local club in Slovenia. And, you know, like you kind of feel like good on the bike and you feel like that's it. It's the first time you start doing something, and it's the first time you like sometimes pay attention to nutrition and stuff. And you feel like this is, yeah, working. And then when I got to Birmingham, like starting my PhD, I started to better understand, okay, perhaps carbohydrates make sense sometimes. Carbohydrate periodization is the way to go. And then Sam Impey, at the time, a big promoter of like carbohydrate periodization, was a postdoc here. And I learned a lot from him. And that's when I basically made a conversion to a high carbohydrate or periodized carbohydrate diet, which I'm still a fan of to this day.
So people know, so I know I'm on the same page. When you say periodized carbohydrate, does that just mean using the carbs around hard or really long sessions? So just timing your carbs at different times? Or if that's incorrect, what do you mean by periodized carbs?
Yeah, this is kind of something that I think the definition of has changed over the years, and people see it differently. So you will see like some people like periodizing carbohydrate, like strictly like looking at a training session. Okay, a hard training session coming ahead, like, yes, high carbohydrate diet. And then before like an easy session, people would completely restrict carbohydrate intake and try to make it like low glycogen training session, which I'm not a big fan of. For most people, at least, or in most scenarios. But you just like kind of think ahead, okay, I have a hard training session the next day. Okay, today the dinner will be simple, like really let's fill up the glycogen stores. Or if the next day is an easy session, okay, perhaps I can have more fiber, some more like fatty meat or something to just also get that side of the like nutrients that you need. So at the end of the week, you have a balanced diet. But yeah, sometimes it's really high carb and sometimes it's, let's say, moderate carbs. It's very rarely that you go really low carb.
Yeah, I think I've never been a huge fan of the low carb, especially for most amateurs, even though I know you've mentioned that time crunched athletes could benefit from that. And I can link to, I can't remember if it's a podcast or a post you had on that, but the biggest thing that I think you had mentioned was the energy balance is so easy to get screwed up in doing that. And so I always have felt that amateurs training, using their mental energy to focus on the training rather than like, do I eat this many grams? Do I eat this? Have I did it? Like, and then they show up to a session totally flat. They ride through it. They drive themselves into the ground. And like in 3 days time, they're wondering why they feel terrible. It's like, well, because you're not eating enough. So I think just it's a slippery slope that can easily be messed up unless you have someone like yourself guiding them through that on a day-to-day process. What's the thing that really caught my ear, being someone who's, I've always said, hey, 90 to 100 grams of carbs for those more in the US, we have like Cat 1, Cat 2 riders or riders that are just putting out crazy watts. I'm like 120 plus. I talked to my, we're not really friends, but we've done a podcast and stuff. Stephen Bassett, he's 140 plus. You had said that maybe doing 120 out of the gates or even 90 is not the best idea, and that we should be more less carb early and more carb later. And if I have that correctly, can you explain that? And this is kind of, I know you can't talk about full details because the study's not out and published, but where, what, what kind of nuggets from that can you drop on us that might help us understand the best protocol for carb timing during a, let's say, 4-hour race, 5-hour race?
I think like the study that I did, like it was kind of the results were kind of surprising, and I don't think they reveal a lot. So even though like I don't want to like talk too much about them, but I don't think like once it's out, it will answer all the questions. But the biggest idea, like the biggest problem I have with like recommending all out the carbohydrates, let's say 120 grams per hour for 4 hours, is that yes, carbohydrates are super important. And if I could, I would always like recommend the athletes to go with like glycogen loading, 12 grams per kilogram of body mass the day before, and then big breakfast before the start, and then 120 grams per hour, for instance, just carbs, carbs, carbs. But then the problem will become that energy availability will be positive. So it's really difficult to basically like go that high in carbohydrates without being in a positive energy balance, and thus in the long term gain weight. If you do this day out day, every single like day. So then you start thinking, okay, I have a budget of this amount of calories. How do I distribute it for the best effects? And then you start thinking, okay, is it more important to have full glycogen stores, or is it more important that I have enough fueling on the bike? And then you start thinking, okay, we know that with low glycogen stores, you will get fatigued no matter how many carbohydrates you eat. And you also know, we also know that carbohydrate intake during exercise doesn't further spare glycogen stores when you go from 90 to 120 grams per hour, for instance. So there is no like real benefit in going super high in carbohydrates if you don't spare glycogen stores. And like, for instance, 4 hours, 120 versus 90 means four times 30 grams, which is 120 grams, which you could have before the race to fill up the glycogen stores. So then start thinking, oh, this is kind of a lot of carbohydrates that I could use elsewhere, more efficiently probably, and stay in energy balance.
And so when you're saying there's no glycogen sparing, I guess said differently, glycogen is going to get used before the carbs that we eat to provide the fuel. So even if you're eating 120 grams, your muscles are going to want to use the glycogen first. Is that correct?
Yeah. It just will not happen that you will spare muscle glycogen stores. So the idea was then, okay, after like 2-3 hours, what will happen is that the glycogen stores will be empty, and then you start relying on actually ingested carbohydrates. So you then start thinking, okay, when you start relying on the ingested carbohydrates, you obviously want the highest availability of these carbohydrates. And yes, like 120 in this case is then becomes probably, in theory, better than it is to just go with 90 or 80 or whatever less.
So dumb question. Let's say you get to hour two and you're using most of the glycogen then that you already have stored. Say you had been eating 120 grams for whatever reason, but you use the glycogen. And so now as we're saying, okay, now the body's going to start using the exogenous carbs that we've eaten. What happened to the extra carbs in the first 2 hours? Those can't be used later on. Like, why not just start? I guess I don't know. Even if it's not sparing glycogen, wouldn't it be more carb for later in the race? Or it doesn't work that way?
No, because the thing is, what we've actually shown with 90 versus 120 is that like fat oxidation rates were then lower. So basically, you increase the use of carbohydrates in total with the same glycogen use.
Interesting. Okay. So to that point, is there a way... And 99% of the people listening know this, that the reason fat can't be used all the time for riding a bike is it can't create the energy fast enough for our accelerations and going hard. Is there a way to increase that flux? If we have so much more fat energy, instead of thwarting the amount of fat that we can use. Is there a way to like upregulate that? Is that what people are making the case with this low carb training more, or what's your viewpoint on that?
Yeah, this is also like a very contentious debate. Like some people, okay, yeah, low carbohydrate training, you will train the body to use fat. And then I'm always like, well, can you really tell the cells that now you will teach them to use more fat? Basically, if we look, what happens is that the body will just use what's most comfortable at using at different intensities. And like when you have an athlete and he improves over time, obviously his fat oxidation rates will go up naturally because he's just like the capacity in the mitochondria is higher because there is just like more capacity to actually utilize the oxygen, and naturally the fat oxidation rates will go up. And then you can see these, like, I don't know, professional cyclists, obviously fat oxidation rates will be higher than an amateur rider, but not because they've done any like sort of like low glycogen training or anything. It's just because they are simply athletes that train a lot and have the really good mitochondrial capacity. And I remember like a few years ago, and I was kind of surprised about this, I got an ultra endurance athlete. So I think a race across America athlete, like I think he was top five a few times. And I tested him in the lab, like did like a graded test after having a breakfast. And his fat oxidation rates were really high. And I was like, well, do you actually like, do you do any fasted rides or like low carbohydrate rides? And he was, no, I always have breakfast and I always eat carbohydrates on the bike and never do any like low carbohydrate training. It was just that pure volume of the training was made him what he was.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do we know, is it, and maybe it's a combination of both, is it the super high volume that these athletes have done year after year after year, a decade of this, or is it the biologic side? For some reason, they just have really high fat oxidation rates. Is there anything that has like, probably hard to tease that out?
I would say it's both, like it's genetics and like some people are better, whatever you give them, like, you know. In professional peloton, you have people training the same, and then one is top five GC and the other one is just a helper.
Yeah. You made a really interesting comment then about how, since glycogen again is the preferred fuel source, when we have these, we have a bike race on Saturday and we drive to the race and we go and we do our activation session, or people call them openers. I guess we're depleting glycogen then no matter what we've eaten or are going to eat on the bike. So is the recommendation definitely try and do openers as early as possible the day before a bike race? Or should we even consider skipping that so that we're maybe doing openers on Thursday and just resting and driving to the event on Friday?
Well, if we look at the really old studies like a glycogen loading, you will see that basically it was like, it started, I think, with a 3-day glycogen loading protocol. So it was 3 days of low carbohydrate diet and then 3 days of high carbohydrate diet. And they did not do any exercise. And then obviously like, yeah, well, that leads to a lot of carbohydrate stores in the muscles. But then like more recently, like this is just not something people would do in reality. And my view is that activation sessions are probably good for like just for the feeling, for the mental stage, and like from muscle activation standpoint, which is not just the metabolism. So I would probably say, yeah, it's a good idea to have them. It just like depends on what you do. You try not to do too much to actually kill yourself. And yeah, the earlier you do them, the more time you give yourself to basically replenish glycogen stores. And like super compensate for like the most important races.
Okay. That's good feedback. And I like to hear the 12 grams per kg. It's a lot of carbs if people actually math it out, we'll say. And I've always said 10 to 12 to people, and they're like, just seems like a lot of carbohydrate. But then they do it and they're like, whoa, I had some crazy legs that race. It's like, well, you had a ton of fuel, so it's a good thing. What do you think about, I know you talk a lot about Haribo as your number one fuel source recommendation. What is, do you see any difference, and maybe just for like general health also, of taking sugar, refined sugar that's candy versus something more natural like maple syrup. Are there any, you know, do we know this in general science of like byproducts left behind when the energy is used up, or is it all the same and just as long as it's a simple sugar that can be processed easily, that's what we want?
I mean, carbohydrates eventually all get broken down, broken down to simple sugars, so glucose, fructose, mm-hmm. galactose, and this mm-hmm. gets absorbed and completely gets oxidized. The difference between less processed and more processed carbohydrates is either like the bonds are longer, so there is a chance of like, I don't know, the digestion to take to be slower, which is one side. And the other one is what is added. Like you have different types of like simple sugars, like table sugar, cane sugar, maple sugar, whatever. And then you have perhaps like brown sugar has more minerals, let's say it. Whether these minerals would do anything, I don't think so, because you're not like, you get minerals elsewhere in like normal food. So it's really down to the context. And this is why like, I kind of also see like carbohydrate periodization as that comes to play, which is that also you choose, let's call them less healthy carbohydrates on the days when it really matters, when you are after filling up the glycogen stores. And then when you're doing that, you want simple foods, very simple foods, because you don't want a lot of fiber, you don't want a lot of fat, because it's just add-on energy that you don't need. But then on other days when the carbohydrate demands are not great, then you want to avoid these foods because you don't want to have sugary items and empty carbohydrates probably when it's not necessary, because you also still need the minerals, you need the vitamins, you need all the micronutrients. It's just like how you manipulate the intake around this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point, manipulating the intake and finding the right times to eat things. And I think as an amateur cyclist, the thing that I had fallen into was I have these race foods and cereals and candies and breads and whatever. And then the race is over and then it's Monday and that food is still there. And then I'm still eating it. And I'm like, wait a minute. Okay, I don't have a race on Tuesday. I probably need to wean off this. And it's finding that balance has always been somewhat tricky for me. So what do you think about, you had mentioned like the low fiber. I know a lot of athletes that quote unquote eat healthy as cyclists, the low fiber thing seems split, but are there people that ever have, and this is kind of a funny question, but I think could be a real life implication question if someone starts to try and do this and maybe doesn't test it. Like if you're used to eating high fiber, you probably have super regular bowel movements, you go low fiber. Have you ever heard people complain of like, ooh, I felt super bloated because they just ate a totally different diet before this race, trying to follow that protocol?
Yeah, like when you see even professional cyclists, sometimes like some will just, even though you recommend a low fiber, they will probably still have some fiber just because they want it and they feel like it works better for them. So I think even like looking at how fiber affects like body mass, because we sometimes recommend, or I go with a low fiber diet for like 3 days before a race, some will like lose because of that like a couple of kilos, and some will just lose zero amount of body mass just because like we are so different in responding to this. So I think this is very individual and it's like worth trying out. I kind of like to think that even before like intense sessions, you can try this out and then see how it is, and then another point like that I see is in professional cycling is, for instance, the starts are late. They're like starting the race at noon or at 1 o'clock, whereas amateurs usually start much earlier. And that's a big difference on how like, yeah, the natural needs are. Because usually most people probably go to have bowel movements in the morning, I guess. Since it's the race time.
That you had an interesting comment somewhere where I get this question very often of, okay, well, how many carbs do I eat that morning then? And you broke it down very simply, and tell me if this is still up to date. If you have 3 hours or more until your event, you go 3 grams per kilogram of body weight. If you have 2 hours, you go 2 grams per kilogram of body weight. And if you only have 1 hour until your event and you wake up, you just go 1 gram of carbs per 1 kilogram of body weight. Is that still like a good protocol that you recommend to people?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like this all comes down from the fact that like for during exercise, for instance, we know that you can absorb like 60 grams of glucose per hour. Most mm-hmm. complex carbohydrates out there are like basically made out of glucose. So if you go with 1 gram per kilo, you are just above like 60 grams per hour, probably, usually.
Mm-hmm.
And because you don't have just glucose-based carbohydrates, you add some like fructose-based as well, you should be fine with these amounts. Like if you really structure it well, you can go a bit higher. But I don't think it's like you want to go too high in the morning because obviously you don't want full gut when you start mm-hmm. the race because you will have the in-race fueling anyway.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to the first thing we talked about of 120 to start is not better than 90. So if we're just shoveling in all this food way too early, you know, I've left the hotel and I see someone who's starting a race in an hour and they're scarfing oatmeal and breads. I'm like, how are they about to go ride a bike right now? Usually it's a lower category, so they're probably going to go learn a lesson that day. But it's you know, I think the big gravel scene here in the U.S. has people freaked out of, I need to be having the biggest breakfast ever. And then they get on the bike and similar to the same thing of test it before you go do it. They're like, whoa, I feel terrible. And it's like, well, yeah, it's hard to ride a bike when you've just gone through the buffet 5 times. So,
I mean, it's very simple. Like when you think about like physiology and what actually is happening, like you should have done your homework. And your homework was to fill up the glycogen stores the day before. And you think like, when is it, at what time is the body the most efficient at storing glycogen? It's after exercise. So you need to do after the activation session your most of the glycogen intake, because this is where the body will store most glycogen. And the next morning, basically what you're doing is you slightly top up the muscle glycogen stores, and you mostly work on liver glycogen, because liver glycogen has been like somehow reduced by the fact that you were using some of the glucose during the night. So you don't need like hell loads of carbohydrates in the morning in the first place, I think. And if you go too high, basically you start with like high insulin levels and then fat oxidation rates is suppressed from the early on. And I don't think you need that for the race.
Yeah. I like that the do the homework is eating the carbs. That's going to make so many people happy. When you have mentioned a couple times of the reduced fat oxidation rate, what are, can you, like just off the top of your head, like what are some values, or like how much are we, what does that actually mean in numbers? Or like we hear that all the time, like, oh, I reduced my fat oxidation rate. Like, does that mean that you burn a certain percentage more carbs, you burn a percentage less fat? Like, can we put any values to that, to, or maybe like, so it's easier for people to conceptualize versus just this general idea of like, oh, my fat oxidation is less.
Well, yeah, I don't want to really put the numbers in, because the thing is like when we do tests in the lab, it's not a race scenario. So I don't want to speculate what happens in the race, because when you're standing on the start line being nervous and anxious about the start, probably the carbohydrate oxidation rates will go up just because of the all this anticipation. And I'm never a big fan of like calculating and predicting the fat and carbohydrate oxidation rates in a race, because this is not how it actually works. But from my experience, when you do a session with breakfast, or you can see a reduction. So for instance, without breakfast, perhaps fat oxidation rates will be, I don't know, 0.5 grams per minute, and then with a breakfast they would be down to like 0.2 grams per minute. Which is, can be substantial. I don't think that, or like in some scenarios it could be that this could be also seen in the like race scenario, but it could also be much less or be no difference. So it really depends, I would say.
Do you think in the future we'll have more race day data and sensors on athletes that are going to be able to answer these types of questions? Like just, you know, the anticipation that you bring up, and that might raise fat oxidation and what actually goes on in a race. It's so much different than in the lab. Is that sort of where you see the future going of sports science and carb research, or what's kind of, how do you see the future unraveling a little bit?
Yeah, I feel like there will be more and more gadgets because they sell. not
It's true.
necessarily because they are useful.
What's a useful gadget that Tim would be looking for? Or what's something that you're like, I wish this was out there right now?
I don't know. Like, I sometimes I feel like I have at disposal all the equipment from the lab, and then like you do a training session. I don't want to use this all this. Masks and everything for the training session. It's not going to make me any faster whatsoever. And sometimes I'm like, well, what is this data going to help me with? Probably nothing. It's just like sometimes we overcomplicate, and I think this is for amateurs very true. Like they want exact numbers, threshold 300 and something x watts. If I go 1 watt higher, it's gonna be completely different story than going 1 watt less. When you look at the trainings of professionals, it's not like this. It's more relaxed, and it's basically just you just need to train and do the amount of work and stuff. Like, even like I sometimes find it funny when people are like weighing the food and like every single gram. Like, yes, it's good to have like a broad idea, but then you have no idea how many carbohydrates there actually are in the product you just got. Because yeah, things change. There is a variation. I think by the law in the United States, it's plus minus 20% of variation in the calories.
What?
Yeah.
That is crazy.
I'm pretty sure this is the like, yeah.
Wow.
So, and I'm pretty sure that it's plus minus 5%. And then you have a power meter, and then you have different efficiency on the bike. So like 18 to probably 24%. And you have a huge error in all these estimations. So just weighing every single gram is not going to make you any better because, well, you just are working with pretty much a lot of error elsewhere. So like focusing on the wrong stuff.
So do you recommend then focus on following your body's sensations the most for fueling? And I've always tried to tell people, for especially for long rides, bring extra. Whatever you think you need, just bring. It's not weighing you down. Bring, maybe your friend needs a snack. They're going to bonk. Like, but there's going to be that day when you come home, you're like, whoa, I ate everything? Like, you might have been burning more that day. As you're bringing to light, maybe this the carb count was way off and you had just enough because you thought you brought more. What sort of, how do you, maybe even when you're talking about like the Bora team, eat by how you feel? Think of like, general, hey, I've got a hard session. I'm going to make sure I eat a little bit more carbs. Or what's, how do you explain that to people?
It's really individual. I think like some riders really want really like exact things, and some riders are more relaxed. Like I personally, my recommendation is always like, did you have a general idea of what you need, especially if you're at high level. So you like, for instance, would weigh the pasta, would weigh the I don't know, potatoes, and like get an idea of how many carbohydrates you are supposed to be getting, but then leave space for like, I don't know, for a sauce, and everything is just, you just estimate. And then also on the bike, like you think about it, like you have 40 gram gels, you actually get all these 40 grams of carbohydrates out of your the gel packaging? Yeah. Probably not. So all these things you need to like kind of take with a pinch of salt, and you're likely usually underestimating most of the time, I would guess.
I like that. It makes it, I like the less stress, just more go with the flow vibe. It's the less stress, the better we are as performing athletes. So I think that's a good all around recommendation. So would the take home, someone's listening to this, especially to the newer cyclists, they're getting, okay, maybe more is not always better. I'm going to try and time my carbs and maybe really make sure I'm focusing on them towards the later portion of the ride. Anything else that you would add to that summation that I maybe had left off?
I mean, like for most people, like I think going with 80 to 100 grams per hour, I think makes most sense. Like this is like kind of a general rule, and this has been recommended for ages now. And I think like even in professional cyclists, it makes sense to go with that rate. It's kind of, especially like in the summer heat, we know absorption of carbohydrates or utilization, ingested carbs is much lower. So you can't expect to eat 120 grams per hour on a really hot day. But having this capacity to actually go high, for instance, if you feel low and you feel okay, then okay, go for it. You perhaps benefit, but you first make sure that you have eaten enough before. I think this is the most important thing.
Do the homework is what you're saying again.
Because sometimes, like in races, I actually go with like recommend high carbohydrate intake in the middle of the race, because like towards the end, it might be really difficult to eat. So you basically like always think, how am I going to get the carbs at the right times? Because not all the carbs get absorbed immediately, but you just kind of also need some time to absorb them. So for instance, like you can imagine your gut being like a funnel, so you can fill it and then it will slowly be absorbing or letting the carbs into the bloodstream. So before the intense beat, you can like fill up the gut, and you like, let's say you have a climb, 20-minute, 30-minute climb coming up. You don't want to eat on the climb really, because it's going to put you out of the rhythm. It's really difficult to kind of get the gel out of the pocket because you're concentrating on riding. So you can have more before that climb. Like instead of having a gel every 20 minutes, you have a gel every 15 minutes to actually go to, I don't know, a bit more than 100 grams per hour. And then on average, in the end of the race, it's going to be 100 grams per hour or 90 grams per hour. This is what you're after. I don't think it's timing is that important, especially towards the middle and the last part. It's the start that you probably don't really need in the first hour going super high in carbs.
I love that highlight again. Do the homework, gotta come. So eating the carbs beforehand is more important. I mean, I'm not saying that carbs during the race is not important, but really focusing before, doing the homework the night, the day before, and coming in totally glycogen stores filled is the most important aspect. Is that correct?
Well, that's how I see it. And I know some nutritionists probably disagree with me, but I haven't seen any evidence for...
We're here for your opinion. Forget everybody else. Yeah, no, I want Tim's opinion. And then let's say we pop a gel. I know we can't, like, not 9.3 minutes. How fast does that work? How fast do we get that energy available to us?
Well, it probably gets into the bloodstream, like, first. Molecules really quickly. But then... We usually see, like, let's say that you start like eating carbohydrates when we do like perform on trials in the lab, and we usually give people like, let's say, 120 grams per hour or 90 grams per hour. You will only see the peak in oxidation rates after like 90 minutes. So it takes some time to actually get there. So it's always about, you probably want to have like 60 minutes before the most important parts, you want to be like pretty high in,
that's huge. Okay, so if you're eating in the last hour of a long training ride, is that carb then? I guess is really more going towards recovery, and is that part of restoring the glycogen, or is that just getting still like torched through? You obviously don't stop and the body doesn't just like stop exercising and working, or when does it like start to count towards recovery of restoring glycogen stores?
Yeah, I would say so, that this is the case. Like there is a couple of studies, I think, that demonstrate, and everyone is citing that 120 is better than 90, but they were actually only looking at recovery, and 120 was better at recovery. And I think this was the reason why, because basically the carbohydrates were not absorbed and they contributed towards the recovery. So we are back to the previous question: is it more important to have carbohydrates before or during? Because basically, it's again for before exercise.
Okay, it's all coming full circle now. Yeah. My last carb question for you: you had mentioned that then in the heat that we don't absorb as many carbs, if I heard that correctly, or what's the deal with carbs and heat?
So yeah, what happens in the heat is that let's say at rest, you have like blood going everywhere in the body at relatively small amounts. Then at high intensities, when you are like, doing, let's say, VO2 max intervals, your muscles are basically limited by the supply of oxygen. So basically, like muscles of high trained athlete have the capacity to use more oxygen than what you can deliver. So VO2 max is limited by the supply of blood, basically, to the muscles. In the heat, what happens is, well, blood also goes to the skin to cool you down. So you have a reduction of VO2 max probably, and reduction in oxygen coming to the muscle in the heat because of that. And what happens generally during exercise is that the blood is redistributed from all other organs because, well, you're pushing hard and you need to cool down. So pretty much there is no perfusion anymore in the gut. And because there is no perfusion, there is also probably not a lot of absorption going on. So that's why you have gastrointestinal discomfort in the heat, because the perfusion of the gut is really low. So the nutrients are not really coming in. And this is one of the reasons, and probably the main one.
Sorry, I don't know. What's perfusion mean?
It's just like blood flow.
Okay. So would you, and when we talk about heat, about, and I'll have to do a translation because of course I'm in Fahrenheit. What is heat to you? Like, how warm are we talking that this starts to take place?
Well, it's never like, we just can't just talk about the temperature. We also need to talk about humidity. So humidity, like 30% humidity and like 70% humidity, it will be a massive difference at, I don't know, any temperature. So like when I train at home at, I don't know, this is like 14 degrees and really high humidity. I don't know, 14 degrees Celsius.
14 is 57.
Yeah, this is low temperature, right? Mm-hmm. But if my humidity in the flat would be like 80%, I would feel hot because the water will really have will struggle to evaporate. And if the humidity at the same temperature was like 30%, then I would be probably flying through the intervals or really like even feeling cold. So it's always both that's need to be taken into account.
Okay. And then for the riders that talk to you about this, say they're getting ready for the tour or someplace where it's going to be warm and they obviously still want to be training VO2 max. Do these athletes just knock the wattage target down, or do they flip more to heart rate at that point, or do it by RPE? How does that come into play with their training? Well, maybe if it's hot.
I don't know how they do it, but I, as a physiologist would always do it heart rate based, and like the first lactate threshold stays at the same heart rate. So I usually like when I train, actually, I usually for the first lactate threshold, I purely use the heart rate power. It's just like to cleanse and look at it like, okay, yes, I'm probably actually at the first lactate threshold. And then for the intervals, I usually just pretty much, it's watts, but also the feel and where the heart rate is, because heart rate has a bit of a lag. Which is a bit annoying, but yeah.
I think that's kind of goes with your comment about even with nutrition of the pros go with the flow. Sometimes, you know, athlete X might be doing threshold at 300 and sometimes they might be doing it at 285, and that's just what you have that day, and you have to go with the flow. And it's not a bad session. It's just, hey, you're not hitting a grand slam home run today. That's just what you're at. Go as Colby Pierce was on here. He said, go make that 285 feel like 300 and just go hard. Go give what you got. So
yeah.
Anything else is we're kind of getting into, it gets hot here where I'm at early in the year. Any other heat tips or tricks that people should be aware of that might affect their training? I think that's interesting about the carbs.
Well, it's always like do heat acclimation. It's not going to really help you with the carbs, but like, the most you can do is basically do heat acclimation, which is like the single most important thing.
And is that just go ride outside when it's hot, or also try to get in the sauna, do things off the bike, or is it pretty much just exercise in the heat as much as possible?
Well, that's the best thing. Like, but if let's say, like, I remember like a few years ago, I was in Slovenia, and then it was like a really cold spring. And I was expecting that the heat wave would come sooner or later. And what do you do? Like, I can't really train in the hot. I don't have access to the hot heat chamber. Like, I do at the lab in the uni. So what I was doing was like hot baths after the training sessions. You finish a training session, straight into the hot bath for like 15 minutes, experience some pain there, being really hot, and then do it like a few times a week for a couple of weeks or so. And then the heat wave eventually came, and then everyone else was really struggling, and I was just like, oh, it's a nice day out here.
I didn't know about that. So is there any benefit, you know, should you do that before you start the training also, or is it pretty much just like a post-training thing, go sit in a hot bath for 15 minutes?
Oh, it's a post-training, because like what you do with the training beforehand is basically raise the temperature of the body.
Okay.
And then you just maintain it and you sweat it out like, during the, because like, for instance, what happens is, let's say you have a temperature of the body, you can measure it at different sides. So one side, the most important one for some people, is the core temperature. So the core temperature goes up in the heat, we know that. But when you do intervals in the cold, you also get the core temperature up. So like, let's say 37 degrees is what is a normal temperature. During exercise, you will always get the temperature to like 38 degrees. And then if you're doing intervals, VO2 max intervals, it's going to happen that your core temperature is going to go to even to 39 degrees, which is kind of what the same amount as you would get in the highest heat. The problem or the difference being that the skin temperature in the cold will be really low, because there will be a big gradient, because you will just dissipate the heat towards the skin, and the skin will be just cooled down by evaporation of the sweat. In the heat, this will not happen, because, and you will see like core temperature will be 39 and the skin temperature will again be 39, and you will feel like horrible and hot. And what you do with your hot bath is like you raise the temperature of the body by doing training session, and going into the hot bath is going to just like maintain the skin temperature really high, and then the heat will just not be able to escape the body, and it will stay there and it will make you like suffer, and body will adapt.
So people don't pass out in the bath, or make sure someone knows that you're in there. We don't want people drowning. Is there any, and this is kind of getting nitpicky, but I'm just thinking logistically of people who are like, I don't really want to get in a bath. Like, what about a hot shower? Can you just stand in a shower? Do you really more need to be submerged?
Yeah. You probably want to be like, it's either sauna or hot baths. That's something that people were using like in research and have been pretty like successful in doing that.
Okay. And last nitpicky question, which probably sounds annoying, but how fast do you need to like get out of your kit and get into this? Are we talking like, hey, get off the bike, you've got 10 minutes or otherwise it's pointless? Or is it like, go in and eat something and go down in half an hour to the sauna? Or is it just go as fast as you can?
Yeah, you probably want to go as fast as you can. Like, and ideally, like when you come back, like you don't want to do like a proper cool down, because, well, you will just do a cool down. And then also you don't want to like, be in the cold. So you want to wear some layers before going in, just to maintain as much heat in the body as you can.
Okay. Interesting. This could have been a whole other podcast. Man, Tim, I appreciate you coming on. I want to be respectful of your time. I know you have a million things going on. So thanks for taking the time to do this. My last question is that you're on Instagram and you post stuff there. Also on Twitter, we'll put a link there. Do you blog, or is there any other place that people should follow along for just content or studies that you put out or things like that?
I'm mostly, present on Instagram, although due to the time limitations, I'm less and less present there. And on Twitter, I just like have a profile with some followers, but sometimes I retweet some studies, but that's pretty much it.
And when's the study that you're working on? Do you know when? I know I'm sure you don't have like a date, but when do you think that'll come out if people are looking forward to reading the findings that you guys come across?
When I write it, which is kind of, I'm really slow at the moment.
Fair enough. We'll keep our eyes out for it. Tim, thank you so much for doing this. Everybody, thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll talk to you all soon. And cut. Let me stop this real quick.